In this episode of Devil We Know, a shadow of hatred towards the black community extended its reach once more to the once slavery-ridden region of East Texas. In one small town in the late 1990s, a black man was beaten and brutally killed by three white men as they drove along a stretch of rural road. In the wake of his murder, the national understanding of hate crimes grew to a great extent, as the fear that these men, and others like them, were more prevalent than even the U.S. government ever realized.
You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
The word backwoods and backwards are eerily similar, and in some ways, they both help to describe the area of East Texas where, 100 miles northeast of Houston, lay the lumber town of Jasper, Texas. Jasper, called the Butterfly Capital of Texas in honor of the Butterfly Festival it holds every year, holds the festival on the third Sunday in October. It's a tradition that has helped bring in tourism and revenue in a town that otherwise mainly relies on its place in the timber industry. The logging town, rife with historical callbacks to the slavery that used to run rampant there, sits so far east that it almost counts as a Louisiana city instead. Jasper served as the home of not just butterflies, though. It was also home to one James Byrd Jr., born to James Sr. and Stella, alongside seven other children. Although he was born in Beaumont in 1949, it was in Jasper that the Byrds raised their burgeoning family, and as child number three among eight, James Jr. was raised with great expectations. James had a childhood that revolved around the church, and his mother worked with Sunday school classes while his father, James Sr., served as deacon at Greater New Bethel Baptist Church. During this time, James also learned great proficiency in piano and singing. It was clear that he had talent, even early on, and that talent came with a strong work ethic that James applied in school. As a student, he was well encouraged and self-assured. In fact, he excelled in his classes, and even his two older sisters had gone before him to leave for college. James belonged to the class of 67 from Jasper Row High School, the last segregated one of the school's history, but his hard work and high marks didn't carry him to college with his sisters. Instead, James met and married Thelma Adams a few years out of high school, and together they grew a family of their own. The two of them had three children, Renee, Ross, and Jamie, all of whom grew up in East Texas like their father. It was a rocky time for the area, of course. Parts of the town were still significantly separated by race, even with the desegregation movement rising in the South. But there was enough local opportunity that James could find work to help support his family. He chiefly did this by working as a vacuum salesman, but his other occupation tended to not mix well with this one. James, unfortunately, had a problem with alcoholism, and his stints of acting on these impulses put him out of work intermittently. It didn't help things that James also suffered from seizures, meaning that he couldn't drive. Soon, between that and his alcoholism, he found himself collecting disability instead of sales. The alcohol, though, was a chief reason for James's life turning upside down, work or no. His wife Thelma left him not long after, filing for divorce and taking the kids with her. 3 years after that, in 1996, James was living in Jasper once more, all alone in a small apartment. His alcoholism had gotten the better of him, and it didn't help that he had found trouble by skipping parole earlier on after a petty theft charge landed him in the clink. It was a tough situation to be in. But it was evident that James was loving, and he aspired to be the father his kids deserved. So despite his marriage's troubles, James committed to making himself better. He even attended Alcoholics Anonymous to work on himself, and he was said to be friendly, charismatic. He was known as a guy who always wanted to have a good time. And although at least one good time led to James spending time in prison for petty theft and for violating parole, he was, as all who knew him agreed, a good man to be around. Troubled, perhaps, but good. He was held in high regard by those who knew him, and for the town of Jasper, which was steeped in racist traditions of the past, that may have been a good start.
But not everyone in the sleepy southern town of Jasper, Texas, felt that way about James. There were others in the community who planted in the soil of racist sentiment an archaic way of American life, ripened with hatred for James and other black members of the town. As a lumber town of only about 7,000 people, this dark, dangerous part of the country, traversing Texas and Louisiana, gave birth to people like Russell Brewer. Russell was short, but he was dangerous.
A white supremacist out of Sulphur Springs, Russell was born in 1967, and it wasn't long before he took a life of drugs, burglary, and acts of hatred towards the black people of Texas.
He spent time in prison for two of those things already before 1998, and it was only a matter of time before he paved his own path to prison for the third as well. Russell was known for his apathy toward his crimes, and he spent over 10 years in and out of prison, where he soon joined the white supremacist movement, a move which he claimed he made so he would have safety during his time in prison. But Russell, criminally hateful though he was, played only one part in the three-man crime that would change the history of Jasper, Texas forever. Russell acted in tandem with two other men, one of which was William King, whom he met in prison. There was another man in Jasper, Sean Berry, who consistently acted as the third wheel in this trio, a man who also spent time in prison with the others. However, Sean worked for a living at a car dealership, as well as being the manager of the Twin Cinemas downtown. Sean knew Bill from school, and in fact the two friends dropped out in 10th grade, though the connection between Bill and Russell, the bond of the two cellmates, seemed to Sean to always be somewhat stronger. Sean fell out of place among them, always acting out to fit in, but his life was simply different. Apart from the fact that Sean had a job, he also spent time carving rocking horses for kids, and his other hobbies included bull riding and weightlifting. Sean was also a steroid user, but he also made a life for himself with his wife, Christy Marcantle, whom he had a child with. Although the marriage was a result of the common law in Texas, Sean and Christy nonetheless were together until the horrors that followed when, once again, Sean felt the need to just go along and to participate in the actions of his two so-called friends. He may have felt like a third wheel, but all three men drove their own lives down the darkest path in 1998. All of them, regardless of their differing lifestyles, brought hell upon their little town.
Bill, the group's ringleader, was once a very happy baby, according to his adoptive parents Ronald and Jean King. The Kings adopted Bill when he was only a few years old, and according to many, Bill was a regular child with a standard Baptist upbringing for a kid in East Texas. Despite the influence of the church, though, it turned out that Billy simply couldn't help being bad. Early on, his adopted mother would cover for him, making excuses, a habit that Bill himself learned from the life he led. According to Ronald, Jean had invested a lot of love in that boy, an investment that she never received a return on. Unfortunately, Jean died only 2 days before Billy's 16th birthday. And Ronald, Billy's adopted father, claimed that the trauma from that was what caused Bill to only change for the worse. In fact, it was around that time that Bill took interest in some dark dealings. For one, there was his unhealthy inclination toward the dealings of the Ku Klux Klan. Although Bill didn't show himself to many as a raving racist until later in life, There is no denying that Bill had a book checked out under his name. A book about the KKK. Bill may have been a reader, but it was clear later on that the seeds of hatred started early inside him. Bill also exhibited prowess as a writer, according to multiple sources. However, it wasn't long before he, along with his friend Sean Barry, left school for good. That wasn't the troublesome part, though. The part that worried Bill's father was how Bill left. He and Sean had, in fact, been arrested for burglary, which led the two of them serving time at a boot camp, and Bill was sentenced to 10 years probation following release. There was more, though. More trouble for Bill. More things that Bill decided to do with himself afterward. The town of Jasper, Texas, known for its lumber and for its annual butterfly festival and the surrounding county full of rural remnants of the Old South, offered not much to keep Bill occupied. Not much, that is, except the vast field of opportunities and criminal activity. It was in that field that Bill specialized, as he was arrested for many crimes over the course of his youth and adulthood. For the amount of trouble he caused, Bill was eventually sent to the Jefferson County Restitution Center, located in Beaumont, Texas. At places like the center, defendants often perform service to others as their way of paying for the crimes against certain claimants. So Bill served, but it wasn't long before he grew bored of that too, and at age 19, he ran away from the center. He was able to stay hidden from the law until over a month later, when he was found and sent to the Liberty County Correction Center. He was then told to complete 800 hours of community service work. It was not a match made in heaven, though, because Bill continually made problems for the correction center, enough so that they eventually terminated his service. He was sent to boot camp once more, where he served 6 more months. But Bill was far from finished with the trouble he loved to cause, even with the weight of punishment firmly placed on his shoulders. When Bill was released from boot camp, he was sent back to the center where, surprise, surprise, again he didn't follow the rules. Soon enough afterward, his probation was revoked, and he was sentenced to 8 years in prison. It was there that Bill met his other partner in crime, a man named Lawrence Russell Brewer Jr. The two were cellmates in the men's maximum security prison known as Beto 1 Unit. Beto, co-located with 3 other prisons and the Gurney Unit Transfer Facility, was designed to hold over 3,000 inmates. It also served as a festering breeding ground for some of the most noxious followings in America, such as the Aryan Brotherhood. It was to groups like these that Bill and Russell Brewer, his new cellmate, latched on while serving their time. And in fact, Bill had made a name for himself with the white supremacists there in only 2 years' time. Covered in tattoos of racist imagery and references to neo-Nazism, Bill rose to the top of the Klan group known as the Confederate Knights of America, the CKA and the Texas Rebel Soldiers Division. The group, which was formed while Bill was in prison, held Bill in high regard as a ringleader, so much so that Bill often referred to himself as the Exalted Cyclops of the CKA, a moniker only a white power fanatic would be proud of. Nonetheless, it was true that whatever anti-black sentiments Bill kept quiet before were now surfacing to a great extent. He not only donned tattoos of swastika, a KKK robe, and a Confederate battle flag, he also wore with pride a tattoo depicting a black man being hanged by a noose from a tree. And while in prison, Bill also discussed at length the merits of starting a race war, and as a prolific orator, many white supremacists would have followed him to the death to start such a war. He was, by all accounts, a scary individual to know, and even a friend of his attested to the alarming growth of his racist sentiments after entering prison. While Russell maintained that the two of them took the white power movement as a means of survival while in prison, Billy's friend Michelle Chapman, who was 18 at the time, was able to prove differently. Between 1995 and 1997, when he was released, Bill sent her 10 letters, with each one reflecting a more violent and unstable position toward not only black people, but those who were Hispanic and Jewish as well. He even referred to race traitors, such as white women who would choose to be romantically involved with black men. He called these women whores, and he stated in one letter that they should hang from the same tree as their black boyfriends, according to Time magazine. It was clear that Bill had changed, not simply for survival, but for a belief that he firmly held. And with his belief in the ideals of the white power movement, Bill had a goal. He aspired to make a name for himself outside of prison in the same way he made one in prison. The scary part was that, after 2 years in prison, this man, hardened toward an entire race of people, made his way back into the world. It wasn't for long that he remained out of prison, but in that short time, Bill found a way to bring hell itself to the people of Jasper, Texas. Although he had a job at one point at a grocery store, living with his older sister, Bill stayed unemployed for quite a while. Bill also spent time breaking other kinds of laws. He fostered inappropriate relationships with multiple underage girls, although he did impregnate an 18-year-old by the name of Kylie Greeny, who later gave birth to his infant son. The two lived together, fighting often and loudly, until eventually Kylie left, having had enough of the trouble that Bill brought home. In addition, Bill didn't stop his Klan lifestyle after leaving prison. He instead stood among the ranks of the CKA chapter that was based in Jasper. And for initiation, members were required to kidnap and murder black people. For someone as blatantly racist as Bill, though, that didn't seem like an issue. In fact, the people of Jasper would soon learn just how dangerous Bill's vision for the town could be. After his girlfriend left him, Bill began living in an apartment with two other men, Sean Barry, the friend he had from his youth, and Russell Brewer, the man who shared his cell in prison.
June in Texas was never so unpleasant as it was on the night of the 7th in 1998. For James, it was meant to be a good day, a day of celebration. His friends were celebrating their anniversary that night, and he had a few drinks to commemorate. After he tossed back his last Busch beer and bid his friends goodnight, he took off, ready to sleep off the night of drinking. He was walking home alone, and it was past midnight when 49-year-old James was tipsily trudging along Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. It was also around that time that three white men, Russell, Sean, and Bill, saw him as they drove together down the same road. Sean, whose truck had a bed, asked if James needed a ride. James and Sean were already acquainted, in fact. They'd had the same parole officer once upon a time. James, already feeling the effects of the party, agreed to a lift, climbing into the bed of the primer gray 1982 Ford pickup. Bill, who offered ardent support to anti-black sentiments, was angry that Sean even suggested picking up the man who now rode in the back of the truck. "That's some ho-ass shit," Bill had said to Sean, using specific slurs to refer to James after having picked him up. It wasn't long, though, before he found a way to make this trip work for him and his twisted goals. All three men had been drinking, and soon they found their way to a gas station to use the restroom, while Bill lobbied to take James out for a scare. The men switched places, with James moving into the cab of the truck while Russell and Bill took the bed. It was there in the bed that they stayed while the group drove out into the boonies surrounding the small town. It should be known that the racist groups to which Bill belonged to had a history of taking inhumane liberties with people of color. One such group was a Ku Klux Klan affiliation, known as the Confederate Knights of America, or the CKA. Bill, who was in fact a leader of the CKA chapter in Jasper, had already done unspeakable things to earn his position. Initiation into the group required members to kidnap and murder black people, a practice with which Bill obviously had no qualms. And so, this forerunner of racist action led his two buddies close behind as they left the gas station,
with Sean driving out toward a rural road known as Huff Creek. Huff Creek, according to locals, was considered part of the black part of town, and it was majorly deserted except for the weekly attendance for Sunday morning church.
But the dark, unlit dirt road was ideal for men who are planning on committing heinous crimes in the dead of night. Bill knew this, and soon he banged on the top of the truck cab, yelling to signal a stop to Sean. And so the four men drove up to a clearing along Huff Creek Road. There, Russell and Bill began to heckle James, and they ganged up on him, beating him to a pulp. They drank, they smoked, they assaulted a man who'd done nothing against them, and the night for them was only getting started. James had sustained serious injuries already to the head and torso, leaving puddles of blood on the grassy clearing and feeling his dentures knocked loose. Russell then took a spray paint can and blackened James' face with it, as both he and Bill began to strip him of his clothes. James suffered continued beatings from the men until he fell unconscious. It was only after all of this that the men took to tying James up with a logging chain and attached him to the back of the truck. They chained him by his ankles, started the truck, and dragged James over 3 miles of dirt and asphalt. His cheek against the dirt part of the road had been rubbed raw, exposing actual jawbone. And soon after being dragged, James awoke in terror. Ankles tautly held together, James knew his best chance was to try and keep from incurring more serious injuries. He held out as long as he could, propping his head up with his elbows to prevent himself from dying. The elbows, which were worn down to the bone by the end of this drive, were only one part of James that suffered through this horrendous display. His ribs were almost all broken, and he was likely pained to even breathe and scream for help. He experienced severe brush burn abrasions all over his body, because the ground rubbed against him until he was raw. In several places, the flesh was stripped from his body, exposing muscle on the legs and exposing the bone in other areas. Some of his toes were gone, and soon the driver passed over a culvert, a tunnel that carries streams or rainwater under a road. At this point, it was over. James' head and right arm were severed from his body with the sheer force of his collision with the culvert. James had been murdered only 3 blocks away from his parents' house, and no one had seen or heard a thing. All at once, the drive had ended, and the men finished their disgusting display by leaving the remains of their victim on the steps of a church. Not just any church, though, no. Their depravity led them to target other black people in this crime by leaving James' mangled body on the steps of an all-black church where he was discovered.
I will be right back after this quick message.
The discovered remains were not identified straight away, however. The body of James was incomplete, and even when his head was found, it was in such a state that it was unrecognizable. But eventually, there was more than enough evidence to know that a frightening amount of hatred had spilled over in the rural streets of Jasper. There were the blood trails and drag marks along the road, showing that the victim in question had suffered 3 miles of torment on asphalt before dying. In addition, the police found the clearing, and the lead investigator, Billy Rawls, knew immediately that something sickening had tainted the air there. There were the puddles of blood and lost set of dentures. There were also beer bottles and cigarette butts. A set of keys were found and loose change. But more interesting and more telling than those were two things. One, there was a Zippo lighter that had the word possum on it, emblazoned with an insignia of the KKK. Two, the police found a wrench set marked with the name Barry. Things were starting to add up a lot more to police. Jasper local Steve Scott also had walked into the sheriff's office to report that he had seen James walking on the side of the road then saw him later inside the gray truck. One person that James knew who had a gray truck was Sean. And so, with a wrench set, a suspicious setting, and a witness placing James in a truck matching Sean's, the police started by reaching out to Sean, pulling him over as he left work at the Twin Cinemas. The police were also discovering that James, who lived alone, was not seen after Steve had witnessed him in the truck. His family didn't know that he hadn't returned home, and so it fell to investigators to find out that the body dropped off at the church belonged to James Byrd Jr., whose head and right arm lay below the road at another juncture, adjacent to a culvert. The idea of what had happened was almost clear, but not quite.
Sean shared an apartment with the other two men, and so when Sean was taken in for questioning, the police soon had reason and license to search the apartment and to take DNA samples and clothing belonging to each man. It was an attempt to ascertain all the guilty parties. The tiny, filthy space was filled with racist memorabilia and decor that was inspired by racist sentiment. Apparently, Bill was not shy about his belief in white supremacy. But it was all quite damning. However, something wasn't adding up quite yet. The murder weapon. How was James dragged all the way along Huff Creek Road? How was he killed? The truck in question on the day of the murder was impeccably clean. For the small town of Jasper, though, many found this surprising. The truck was usually filthy, unclean beyond reproach. Now it was glistening. That fact alone was suspicious, but what about the clues from the road? There were no skid marks, so it wasn't a hit and run. The men had another way of dismembering and essentially lynching the poor victim, who had for so long stayed unidentified. The police eventually made rounds, asking the friends of the group about the night of June 6th. One friend reported seeing Bill with the described Zippo lighter, a fact which placed him with Sean at the scene of the altercation that had obviously taken place. But there was more. The evidence from the apartment stood out as a clear sign of injustice, along with some stolen meat from a local restaurant. The men had kept at their place the shoes that were covered in James' DNA. All three men, it seemed, were involved in the murder at hand, and once the police had discovered it was, in fact, James, the story began filling out. The police found a logging chain buried under plywood and debris in the woods behind the house of a mutual friend. The police also found Bill's DNA on a cigarette butt found in the clearing where the assault began. Finally, there was Sean. Sean, the third wheel. Sean, the enabler. Sean claimed to not have played a part in the deathly events of the night, only stating that he drove. He didn't know, according to his statement, that James was being dragged until it was too late. Most likely, if that was the case, then the culvert taking James' life was the sign that brought Sean to his realization. He had just aided in an assault and murder of another human being. It was after confirming the identity of their victim that Billy Rowles took Deputy James Carter with him to notify the family. Stella and James Sr. learned that their son, at age 49, lost his life to the hands of sinister, hateful, murderous people in the very town they'd raised him. He had been found near a church in the community, legs stretched, feet together, left arm folded across his chest. His death had been the immediate result of a severed head and right arm. At his funeral, James' family had over 200 attendants inside the church they frequented. Among them, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and NAACP President Kwaisi Umfume gave their respects. According to biography.com, over 600 people stood outside the church to do the same. While star athlete Dennis Rodman fronted the cost for the funeral and fight promoter Don King donated $100,000 to James's family, his death, though, would not be the end of this chain of events. Even as James Byrd Jr. was interred in an above-ground vault, which would later suffer desecration from even more Jasper locals, there was still work to be done.
The three men responsible for James's death were arrested, held in jail without bond, awaiting trial. The three of them were to face their consequences, but the United States heard of the crime in an age that was turning its back collectively on such barbarism. It is considered to this day one of the worst and most heinous hate crimes in American history. The shocking news of it and other crimes against the Black American population was mounting to an even more chilling revelation. The darkness of the Confederacy, of the traditions that held America in support of slavery and in the reverence of white supremacy, have an agency in the states that everyone was afraid to acknowledge. However, with James's death came the realization, too, that admission of this flaw meant the need for correction. Mourning for the man who died along Huff Creek Road wouldn't bring him back. But honoring his memory through protection of later generations would immortalize him in a way nothing else could. And so, legislation was pursued. Former President George W. Bush, while still serving as Texas governor, helped to bring about an act which Rick Perry later signed in 2001, called the James Byrd Hate Crimes Act. This act was an effort by the state to enforce penalties for crimes motivated by a victim's race, religion, color, sex, disability, sexual preference, age, or natural origin. But soon, the cause was a national one. In fact, the Byrd family worked with the family of another victim of hate crimes, Matthew Shepard of Wyoming, who was brutally attacked and murdered on the basis of his sexual preference. A young gay man cut down by bigots in yet another backwards town, Matthew's family worked in tandem with that of James's to ensure the passing of another act, known as the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. The act was signed by President Barack Obama in 2009, only 10 months after taking office. This act drew the media's eye to a standing problem before us. Yes, people are murdered. Unfortunately, it happens every day. But more than that, they are being attacked in a multitude of ways on the basis of their identities. It's more than just criminal. It goes to show the complete lack of decency and human character in those that we once may have called neighbors.
While incarcerated, Bill, who was being evicted when the murder took place, claimed innocence in whatever had occurred the night that James was killed, blaming the other two men in his company for the man's murder. Regardless, Bill was the first to be tried and convicted for the murder. And although jury selection alone took 3 weeks to accomplish, the jurors, almost all white, took only 2.5 hours of deliberation to come to the conclusion that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Bill's conviction and sentence to death row made him the very first white man in Texas to receive the death penalty for murdering a black man. In other words, this was the first time that there was actual progress in a Texas courtroom regarding white crime against black individuals. Of course, Bill thought of everything he could to get out of the punishment that he wouldn't receive for another 20 years. He had his attorney hire 2 forensic psychologists. He didn't testify at his own trial, and he even sent a letter to the Dallas Morning News while in prison, claiming innocence once more. This letter, in which Bill pinned the murder on Sean Berry, explained away the loss of Bill's lighter over a week prior to it being found in the clearing on Huff Creek. This statement contradicted with that of a witness who claimed seeing Bill with the possum lighter on the night of June 6, just hours before James was killed. Bill also mentioned in the letter that he knew Sean from jail and that Sean, known for steroid use, had dealt these illicit drugs to him in the past. With this background information laid down, Bill insisted that what occurred between Sean and James was actually a drug deal gone wrong. This desperate act, of course, fell on deaf ears, and soon even Bill's own father, Ronald, came in his wheelchair, hooked up to an oxygen apparatus, to apologize for the wrongs his son had committed. Ronald wrote a note to the Byrd family, giving his condolences and assuring them that Bill was most definitely raised better than to act the way he did. Ronald admitted to the deep shame he felt for Bill and his actions,
but Bill remained stoic up until the day of April 24th, 2019, when he received a lethal injection. He kept his eyes closed throughout the entire process and never expressed remorse, even as James' sister, Luvon Bird Harris, and Billy Rouse of the Jasper PD witnessed the execution. When asked if he had anything to say to James's family long ago, Bill even made a lewd gesture to them, offered a chance for redemption in even a small form. He refused to do so, instead clinging desperately to his racist ideology. Pronounced dead a little after 7 p.m., that day in April was the day that a monster left our midst for good. Sean, who had cooperated during the investigation into James's death, received a life sentence as opposed to capital punishment, with the ability for parole in 2038, at which time he'll be 63 years old. Russell, who also had a separate trial, was also found guilty of murder and received the death sentence after Bill, never expressing remorse for his crime. He even said at one point that he would do it all again, and in 2011, he was executed by lethal injection. At this time, he was given his last meal, and Russell requested everything he could possibly think of. 2 chicken fried steaks with gravy and onions, a triple patty bacon cheeseburger, cheese omelet with ground beef, tomatoes, onions, bell peppers, and jalapenos, a bowl of fried okra with ketchup, 1 pound of barbecue meat with white bread, 3 fajitas, a meat lover's pizza, bluebell ice cream, peanut butter fudge, and root beer. When all of this sat in front of him, though, Russell took one look and said that he wasn't hungry, refusing to eat a bite. It was at this time that the state senator declared that state prisons would no longer serve last meals to inmates on death row, as the entire smorgasbord was thrown out. Pronounced dead at 6:21 p.m. on September 21st, Russell didn't die in front of Billy Rouse as Bill did, but his brother and parents attended the execution, mourning the loss of their son, a loss that most likely happened very long ago.
The men who stood trial for the death of James Byrd Jr. all took different paths, and they even sustained different experiences while awaiting their sentence. But they all made one choice on that warm June night. They chose to break, beat, and destroy another human being. And they had to answer for that. The criminal code in Texas would eventually see to it, but the process was long. It was grueling. There was much invested in the fate of these men, and the world came to see what Texas could do with humans who acted like demons. There are times when people posit environment as a legitimate reason for the things that people do. For example, is a killer born a killer? There are those who say killers are born. There are those, though, who say they are simply made. It's hard to pinpoint because some people in our world's dark history seem almost destined to commit evil acts. However, the world that James lived in was one also tainted with hate and misery. It's rife with reminders, even now, of the darkness that can live in the human heart, of the cruelty that can pervade it. There are reminders all around us like this. But in Jasper, those reminders are especially poignant for people of color. The South has a reputation like nowhere else in America for the propagation of this behavior. But in the end, a person cannot blame their environment for the actions they choose. Bill Russell and Sean made their bed and laid in it that night in 1998. And come what did for each of them, they deserve punishment for their crimes. It's a small price to pay for bringing more evil into the world we live in.
On this episode, we'd also like to feature a band from Phoenix, Arizona, known as Hyperchromatic. Their approach to Baroque rock has brought them numerous shows throughout the valley, and they have recently celebrated their new EP release, Thorns and Leaves. Check them out. And if you're in the Phoenix area, Hyperchromatic plays November 15th of this year at the Mesa Music Festival at the Chupacabra Tap Room. Admission to the festival is free, so come check out Hyperchromatic. Here's a sneak peek at one of their crowd favorites, a song called Grass Crown. Links in the show notes for more. Thank you for listening to Devil We Know. I want to give a huge shout out to Amanda from the State of Perfect Balance podcast. Please subscribe and listen to her podcast. It's absolutely amazing, about little small town murders in Ohio. Best way to support Devil We Know is to join our Patreon for $1. You get 2 bonus episodes a month, stickers, and anything else we can think of. You can also go to devilweknowpodcast.com. Hit the donate button. Any amount of money that you donate to us will go right back into the show, new equipment, etc., etc. Sources: A Death in Texas, A Story of Race, Murder, and a Small Town Struggle for Redemption by Dina Temple Raston. Wayne Goodwin of NPR. Biography.com. The New York Times, Various Issues, Shane Croucher of Newsweek, Eli Rosenberg and Lindsay Bever of The Washington Post, Elliot McLaughlin of CNN, David K. Lee and Alex Johnson of NBC News, The Associated Press and Claire Cardona of The Dallas Morning News, Jolie McCullough of The Texas Tribune, Audrey McNamara and Julie Arcega of The Daily Beast, Associated Press and Los Angeles Times, E.J. Dixon of Rolling Stone Magazine, Associated Press and KTLA Channel 5 News, Chris Perez of New York Post, Danielle Wallace of Fox News, Eris Folly of The Hill News Outlet, and John C. Moritz of The El Paso Times. Research for this episode was done by Kat Morris. Absolutely phenomenal job. Kat is also the research and writer for Active Shooter, the podcast, in which I host as well.